Hey, Alicia Galati here, hopping in real quick to let you know that Professor Evans will be back next week with a new episode. In the meantime, please enjoy this week's Tech Intersect Spotlight of Professor Evans' keynote address at the inaugural Blockchain Law for Social Good conference in October 2022. During this address, she explains the important role of advocates and policymakers to ensure the future of access, inclusion, and equity in a Web3 world. Please enjoy the show.
Welcome to Tech Intersect. I'm your host, Tanya Evans, and my life and work exist at the heart of law, business, and technology. Yeah, I've earned a few fancy titles and degrees over the years, but the bottom line is I'm a writer, speaker, teacher, and lifelong learner, and I'm really excited that you've joined me on this journey. So what is Tech Intersect? Well, it's authentic, empowering conversations with really interesting guests who demystify complex topics to prepare you for the future, because your future is now, and it exists where law, business, and tech intersect. Get ready to listen, learn, and leverage. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. In this episode of Tech Intersect, I'm excited to share audio from my keynote address at the inaugural Blockchain Law for Social Good conference hosted by Golden Gate University Law School and the Algorand Foundation in San Francisco on October 20th, 2022. Shout out to friend of the show, Center Director and Professor of Law, Michelle Neitz, who graciously invited me to speak. And if you'll remember, we had a wonderful Tech Intersect conversation recently about this very topic. So go back in the archives and have a listen to her take on blockchain law for social good and educating law students, lawyers, and policymakers about the power, promise, and social utility of blockchain technology. Now, in my keynote remarks, I explain the important role for advocates and policymakers to ensure the future of access, inclusion, and equity in a Web3 world. And I used my own personal experience as a Black queer woman, as well as statistics from the FDIC, the IMF, and the Ariel Schwab report on Black crypto investors. And I explore the ways that technology can and should be used to decentralize work, wealth, and creativity, and to do so in a way that achieves the optimal balance between encouraging robust innovation, protecting consumers, investors, and businesses, and ensuring transparency balanced with financial privacy, access balanced with security, especially for those who have been historically and systemically disenfranchised in the current financial system. You can see the actual video at the Blockchain Law for Social Good website, and I've dropped the link in the show notes. So before we get started, I have two important opportunities to share with my favorite listeners. That's you. First, I'm planning my very first in-person summit in January 2023 in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Now, I've been talking to club members and Advantage Evans Academy students and alums, and what we all need right now is a reset, a reboot, and an opportunity to reconnect with the course content, especially in this bear market in the crypto economy. And we also just need to reconnect with each other, obviously to do so safely, but an in-person experience can really be invaluable to restart, recharge at the beginning of the new year. So I've decided to teach my entire From Cash to Crypto Encore course content to a small group of highly motivated and committed folks in one beautiful weekend. So if this sounds like something you'd be interested in, please, please, please do not hesitate. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Act now to secure your seat. The link to find out more information and to find out if this is a good opportunity for you and to check to see if there is still space available, use the link in the show notes. Let's go from cash to crypto together. Sun, surf, sand, and Satoshis. Look, as the young folks say, say less and let's go. And as always, a quick reminder on digital safety. Look, there are a ton of scammers out there on social media impersonating me and other folks. And I need your help. Now hear this. I will never slide into your DMs to solicit your time or your money like ever. So be careful and make good choices. And as a reminder, I've developed an entire free masterclass about the topic to move safely and confidently in the crypto space with the security tips and best practices you need to succeed in the crypto economy and the future of money. So check out secureyourcryptobag.com for more information and immediate access to the masterclass. That's secureyourcryptobag.com. Okay, it's time to listen, learn, and leverage. Let's get started. So about that Tech Intersect podcast episode, it usually comes out now. So please look for that at 5 instead of right now. Thank you so much. I'm so incredibly excited and really honored to be here with you today. Hello to everyone for the live stream. Part of what we've learned during the pandemonium years is how great it is to connect in person, but also to really leverage technology to connect with folks around the world. I understand we are doing that today, and so I'm excited for that as well. And thank you to Professor Neitz and the Algorand Foundation for inviting me to deliver this inaugural Blockchain Law for Social Good conference keynote. And it's an exciting and yet a little challenging in terms of the timing this year when I think of all that is going on in the blockchain ecosystem. And it's really important for current and for future lawyers who are helping innovators and legislators, regulators, investors, and consumers to navigate these uncharted waters. And especially given Satoshi's vision, the Cypherpunk Manifesto, this promise of a decentralized, egalitarian world where software code is leveraged really to place power, real economic power, as well as financial autonomy and agency and digital ownership in the hands of many, not just a few. And we're witnessing a significant uptick in interest and also scrutiny from the legislative and executive branches. We've witnessed President Biden take notice and take action in his March executive order. I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. It is titled to ensure responsible development of digital assets. It's led to a series of reports from various agencies that have provided essentially a framework that outlines the recommendations to protect consumers and investors and businesses focused on financial stability, of course, in the United States and abroad, national security, and also the environment. We've also certainly seen regulatory agencies like the SEC, certainly the Department of Justice, the Treasury Department become more active and, I guess, an appropriate term, even more aggressive. And so there's some concern in the space. The industry has been a bit alarmed by actions that have been described as regulation by enforcement rather than the reasoned rulemaking that allows for public comment. And this year we've seen bipartisan efforts. This is something I'm really, really excited about to bring greater regulatory clarity. We hear that a lot in the ecosystem about there's a lot of money on the sidelines if only the rules were more clear. So we have bills introduced by Senators Bozeman and Stabenow, Booker and Thune, and also, of course, Senators Lummis and Gillibrand. And all of this is happening in a bear market, really, where prices across the board of the 21,000 plus coins and tokens and counting has, the value has dropped at least 70% in some scenarios, not really due to the failure of crypto per se, but due largely to the macroeconomics and the global political pressures creating financial chaos and concern around the world. And so I commend the professor and also Algorand Foundation for creating the center to explore myriad legal issues present in integrating blockchain technology and crypto assets in the public, private, and charitable sectors, and the very and various local, national, and international policy issues associated with achieving the optimal balance in a number of different areas. One, certainly encouraging robust innovation, certainly protecting consumers and investors and business, but also ensuring transparency balanced with financial privacy.
You You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Access balanced with security, especially for those who have been historically and systemically disenfranchised by the current financial system. And that last point is particularly important. It's imperative that as leaders in advocacy and representation and problem solving, that we lead the way to an equitable and inclusive future so that blockchain ecosystems and Web3 more broadly will be as good as its promise. We've witnessed a boom in financial technology or fintech, especially since the 2008 financial crisis. And if you've received direct deposit or used PayPal or Venmo or Cash App or Zelle or even a wire transfer, you already are familiar with how digital currency moves. And purely digital currencies actually predate the 2009 drop of Bitcoin in January of 2009. But that brilliant, and if you haven't read it yet, please, please do, Satoshi's brilliant nine-page, maybe 7 or 9 footnote white paper really leveraged decades-old research and existing technologies. We're talking peer-to-peer technology, certainly cryptography for encrypted messaging and the internet and economic incentives that are shared rather than siloed, that responsibility to verify transactional data. That's a game changer. And my specific point of view in my teaching and my writing, certainly in my advocacy, is really to explore and to enhance those aspects of decentralized finance, the blockchain industry, cryptographically secured assets to empower, to include, and to uplift. And a critical and unique opportunity exists to achieve these aspirations, one that hasn't really existed since that dot-com era created Silicon Valley wealth that is almost inexplicable. And the reason is because decentralized financial environments don't care about race or ethnicity or age or orientation or other characteristics. And think about the crypto bull run that really ushered in this new wave of wealthy whales, as we would call them, early adopters in particular who chose to buy or to mine when you can actually do it on a PC, Bitcoin in those early years, and to HODL or HODL, depending upon how you say it. We should take a poll to see as well. But they've seen the value of their portfolio skyrocket beyond Satoshi's wildest dreams. But that class comeuppance, what I call, is really benefiting the privileged few, those with access to tech and to finance, which is also pretty homogenized in terms of an inner circle that rarely includes members of historically and systemically marginalized communities. And this is true despite the dogged libertarian principles of maximizing autonomy, maximizing political freedom, free association, the live and let live individualism, the voluntary association from which Bitcoin emerged. I took a look at the FDIC's website, which defines economic inclusion as when all consumers have access to safe, affordable financial products and services, and that ownership of a transaction account is the essential first step toward economic inclusion. But the reality is that the current system is broken because it doesn't serve all Americans equitably. And in fact, in 2019, an FDI survey titled Key Findings from How America Banks revealed that 5.4% of U.S. households, which is approximately 1.7 million, were unbanked in 2019. And 29% of unbanked households reported not having enough money to meet minimum balance requirements, which is the first most cited reason. And 16.1% cited a lack of trust in the banking system as the main reason for not having an account, the second most cited reason. So couple that with the Black community's historical distrust of the centralized power of government. And when I share some slides with you in a moment, I'll highlight that a bit more. Also distrust of healthcare and the banking systems that further compounds problems with the widening wealth gap. McKinsey & Company reports that a lack of financial inclusion for Black Americans exists at every level of the financial system, and the IMF describes financial inclusion as a critical bridge between improved economic opportunity and improved economic outcomes. So what does financial inclusion mean in the digital future for historically excluded communities? I argue the future of financial inclusion is inextricably linked to meaningful access and opportunities in the digital future built on the rails of blockchain. And despite my educational, career, and financial privilege, I too have learned hard lessons the hard way, which is really hard, in the current financial system that make me downright bullish on an inclusive future in the world of Lex Cryptographica or the law of code. So let me share a bit about my personal journey from cash to crypto as a Black queer woman navigating a financial system built on the backs of people like me, but not built for people like me. Hi, I'm Dr. Tanya M. Evans, author of Digital Money Demystified. And I want to let you know that to stay on the leading edge of any opportunity, especially investing, you have to empower yourself with the tools and resources needed to keep your knowledge and skills current. And if you're relying on last year's information or even last month's, look, you're already behind. Sure, you can try to figure this out on your own at YouTube University. The problem is, it's difficult to separate fact from fiction with so many carnival barkers banking on your inexperience. And of course, there are the naysayers, usually from legacy finance, banking on your fear while they quietly help their high net worth clients to invest. All of it muddies the waters when all you want to know is how to get in safely, legally, and confidently so you're not left behind. That's why I wrote Digital Money Demystified, where I take the top 10 crypto myths head on and give you well-researched, well-supported facts to empower you to make good choices out there in the new digital cash economy. As a law professor who developed the first blockchain crypto and law online certificate program, a retail and corporate crypto policy and education trainer, and a thought leader appearing regularly on national media, I've done the heavy lifting so you don't have to. Look, there are plenty of books and courses on which crypto assets to invest in. Digital Money Demystified is the book you read before you dive into those. So head to digitalmoneydemystified.com to learn more and prepare for the future of money and wealth today. So when I think about my journey from cash to crypto, it really started, let me take one step back, at the end of 2017, long story short, at the time I was at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, and I had a friend who mentioned that she was in some type of working group that had something to do with magical internet money and this thing called blockchain, which I had heard about, but didn't fully appreciate and understand. I'm licensed in 4 states, and I do not intend to ever lose my license. So whatever this magical internet money was, I wasn't sure. But I also am an intellectual property lawyer by training, and the idea of an open source software and some of the issues that come up when you think about layer one technology that necessarily has to be interoperable, but folks starting to build on top of layer one to monetize layer two and above solutions, that was interesting to me, particularly as an IP lawyer. Fell down the rabbit hole. You can listen to Tech Intersect to find out more about that story.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
But when I woke up and hadn't showered in weeks and said, "Mom, this is a revolution," that was something that really caught my attention. My dean sent out a message that said they needed someone in 2 weeks to go to Thailand to speak to, I don't know, a few hundred lawyers to advise them about intellectual property and blockchain. I said yes immediately. If I had to give that speech at that time, it would have been an epic failure. But I always bet on myself. And if someone was willing to fly me halfway around the world to talk about it, it was a really big opportunity and idea, and the rest is history. So I went from there to actually present and to train lawyers at the World Intellectual Property Organization as well. I created the first blockchain, crypto, and law online certificate program while at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. It led to really a second act in my career that is sometimes difficult for an attorney to do, and certainly for an academic. It's led to countless speaking opportunities, and I encourage you, you all don't have to know everything about all of the things in the space, but take a deep dive where you are, and you really can change the nature and structure of your practice or certainly of your future. One of the best things that really led me into the space was serving as the chair of the Maker Ecosystem Growth Foundation. If you know about the Maker DAO and DAI, I was the chair of the foundation to lead it toward full decentralization. I was paid in that token. Please get a good CPA. That's a story for another day. Because when I got those tokens, they were a couple of hundred. You look at coinmarketcap.com and see what happened to that token, and you will see why I am debt-free, my parents are debt-free. It changed the very nature of the way that I operate in this system, where I get to make choices that I've never had the opportunity to make. When I think about how that's changed my family for generations, being able to travel, working and doing everything I want to and nothing I don't, that is power, that is freedom. And even for someone like me, when I went to buy a piece of property, my mom now lives there. I rent, she's in this great home. I have to think about that, actually. But it was one of my greatest privileges. I was working at one time with a bank for a mortgage. They said, it's 100, you know, we don't have to put anything down. But I have had the same job for 20 some years when I think of being an attorney, excellent credit, no children. Where else am I going to spend this money? And they took me through so many ringers that I couldn't even believe it. The same bank that had my money for years, the same bank that had my assets, all of a sudden wanted everything, including my secondborn. I was able to walk away from that table. I was able to be mortgage free. I'm able to be a digital nomad when I want to be. That is an individual impact that leads to the type of social impact where folks who have not traditionally been able to get the best rates actually can make their own decisions. And so this area is not without its problems and its challenges, but that is what we are all collectively working on to make sure the policy that will apply in the space makes sure that there is access and equitable opportunity. When I think of social impact, and I wanted to pull this quickly, when you think about social impact and what you will listen to and hear about on these 2 days that we're together, significant and positive changes, not just for an individual, but for a family, for a community, for a culture, for a state. We're a borderless society at this point. We have to figure out that we are all connected. We all will rise and fall together. The borders that we have created are really social constructs, and we really have to reimagine this hyper-competitive world that we're in and focus more on community, or ain't none of us going to make it. So think about the way that social impact also means social innovation, which is really where we're focused, this idea of leveraging technology in a way that empowers others to have opportunities. And that's really, really exciting when you think about a center that's focused decidedly on social impact and not just on the financial gain or loss on any particular day. I had occasion, both on the podcast and then in some of my presentations on the Hill and in the Commonwealth of Philadelphia, to talk about a Black investor survey that is done annually by Ariel Schwab, a partnership. So Ariel Investments, that's Melody Hobson's firm, and Schwab, of course, Charles Schwab. And I was very interested. This is the first time, I think it came out in March of this year, around March or February, to really look at not just investor habits in general, but for the first time to really focus on crypto investment in the Black community. And they were startled because so many were risking so much in a new and highly volatile asset class, but not buying homes, not buying stocks and other investments. And when you think about how people really start to move the needle as a matter of generational wealth, or to get dynastic wealth, just generational wealth, or even in one generation, it's not being a high income earner. It's really about leveraging assets that work harder than I do, which is my ultimate goal in life. I would like to be in the south of France, which I was in recently. Imagine that. Dream bigger dreams. But not just focusing on high income. Actually, those with considerable wealth don't want any income because it's taxed at a higher rate. How do you acquire assets that work harder than you? So these were startling statistics about those who were more interested in throwing caution to the wind in the crypto space, particularly at the height of the market. So a lot of people got wrecked, to be sure. But there's a crisis in trust. And I wanted to quickly highlight where that crisis in trust comes from, particularly in the Black community. If you have heard about the Freedmen's Bank, that actually comes the Office of the Comptroller of Currency under Treasury. And I commend to you to find out more information about the history of the Freedmen's Bank, which basically had a lot of pie-in-the-sky dreams. It was run by the government. There was one official branch in the D.C., and others crept up unofficially around the country. But many, many people lost their money. There are many times having a savings and loans on the corner. I can think of my grandmother and an example of that when she was growing up in North Carolina. One day you have money and the next day you don't. Happens in a lot of countries now, but actually happened in our country as well. So that crisis in trust has been earned. How do we start as a matter of policy, change that dynamic to change and move the needle on generational, or not even generational wealth, but the considerable wealth gap here in the United States? So the idea of social impact has to move the needle to make things at least accessible and egalitarian. Things don't have to be equal. Equality is different than equity, giving everybody a fair shake to make moves in the same way. These statistics are quite startling when you talk about the median net worth, Black, Latino, and white. And so these are some of the questions that we have to ask and answer as we continue to move forward to create this new future as well. I'm not going to go through that last slide, but I wanted to highlight this one. This idea of assets and liabilities and net worth, and again, changing the discussion from high income to capital assets. Crypto is taxed as a capital asset. We also have to work as a matter of policy to distinguish as a matter of taxonomy the different types. Bitcoin is very different than ETH. ETH is very different than XRP. XRP is very different than a stable. The conversation of central bank digital currencies. We have non-fungible tokens and the way that we leverage that technology, not just for art, but one of one for Ticketmaster sales, for example, as a matter of identity and privacy. There's so many things. The monolithic approach in the crypto space is a horrible way to approach it, and we have to get more sensitive and more savvy as a matter of policy, thinking about the different ways to interact with cryptographically secured digital assets. But the fact that it's taxed as a capital asset is an opportunity not only to be paid the first time, but also to receive something that can go up and certainly can go down. It reminded me, and I wrote about this last year for a series having to do with Kwanzaa and how Kwanzaa principles, it's a national African-American holiday that celebrates a number of principles. One of them is determination. You have purpose and creativity, collective work and responsibility. But I focused on this idea of Kuji Chakalia, self-determination, because a lot of it aligns precisely with cypherpunk principles. When you think about self-determination, autonomy, that led me to this idea of self-custody, which actually can be quite powerful. I want to quickly move through some headlines, level set for future conversations about the technology, and turn you back over to your day. I love to do this headline piece because things change so rapidly. I know it was frustrating to the organizers, like, where are these slides? It's like, I don't know. I haven't read the headlines today yet. They're coming. And this is not from today, but it's helpful to kind of see the arc of how things are developing. When I think of a survey of millionaires really wanting some probably de-risked exposure to the crypto space, and how banks were moving in lockstep to try and give some exposure, but really just to their high net worth clients. So we're not all going to get an email one day that said everything's open for business and we want everybody to come into this ecosystem, sometimes more quietly than others. I love to see what happens like with JP Morgan. It's like, it's drug money, it's horrible, and also we'll be offering it to our clients, and it may actually, you know, value and triple and challenge gold. And so seeing the evolution in the banking space, in legacy banking, has been interesting. Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, as I mentioned, for sure. This is one of my favorite. Deutsche Bank quietly plans to offer crypto custody. Why is it quiet? That sounds a lot like the existing system. We're looking to change things and have it be done differently. Morgan Stanley finally getting in. Bank of America, very tardy to this party, but also getting in. And the list goes on. I love this headline recently, the seismic warning. Here is, you know, the sky is falling and it's raining crypto, but the market adds, and we know that we're in a crypto winter. What goes up goes down and vice versa. This is not legal or financial advice. And also really interestingly, when you think about retirement as well and crypto assets being used in that space as well. Obviously, Cash App has been in the game for a minute. And the ecosystem is really evolving in really interesting ways. This slide lends itself to what I said earlier, that there's so many different ways that cryptographically secured assets can be leveraged. And we can see the evolution. We have our legacy coins, BTC, ETH, etc., stables, central bank digital currencies, certainly decentralized finance. The decentralized method of savings and loans is really particularly interested. I'm obviously biased given my former connection with the Maker Foundation, and obviously NFTs in the metaverse. I wanted to quickly show you, again, even though we're in a down market at this point, and this, I think, is from 2001. I don't have my glasses on. Someone told me I don't want to have to start calling on people, but you can do that. But the idea of the growth in sales in ETH for Black creatives, which has been really, really interesting. I've gotten to know a lot of creatives through my work with NFTs and the NFT Law Guide for Creatives as well, and do some work with Black NFT art. This is Iris Nevins, who has created Black NFT art, and Umba Daima is doing extraordinarily well. This is from this year. Another one of the most prolific and successful artists is also a Black woman in the space, a rapper who has sold more that way than she could have probably if she had been signed to a major deal. So it's been really, really exciting to see. And this is a time when people really start to build. When we think of even with this environment, this regulatory environment, we see what's going on in the SEC. We wonder about what's going on in terms of different products and who among the alphabet soup of regulators will actually take the lead. That's what a lot of the legislative initiatives, a lot of the bills are focused on. Is it going to be the CFTC? Is a matter of primarily regulating commodities unless something functions? And, you know, I'm not going to go to the Howey test today, but this dividing line between the SEC and the CFTC is a really, really critical question to be resolved. And a lot of the resolution of that will lead to greater certainty in the markets as well. Treasury has taken notice, I promise you. I hope that you've already filed your taxes for this year. The extension was on Monday, so you might want to call your CPA if you missed that mark. But thinking about above the fold on the 1040 to ask the question more pointedly, if you've had any interaction with crypto, means that there's a lot of the concern of underreporting and non-reporting in the space, and this is another area where policy is going to really matter. Maybe there should be some threshold, and I know there's some legislation around the way that crypto moves. I might onboard and then buy BTC to buy ETH and then buy an NFT and then sell it next week. We have to be more nuanced in terms of tax policy, excuse me, as well, and pay attention, obviously, to the executive order and the reports, as I mentioned earlier, that are flowing from those. Really interesting and final point about legislation is all of the activity going on in the states. Think of Nevada, certainly Wyoming and Arizona. There's so many states, and even in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we don't have a lot of great legislation that has been passed, but we have some savvy legislators there taking a look as a matter of economic and social justice, and so I'm very encouraged by that. States have always been the sandboxes, and I use, obviously, the word intentionally to see what is percolating up from the groundswell. And may signal future opportunities at the federal level as well. Last 10-ish minutes, 15 minutes tops, I wanted to take a step back, and Professor Neitz asked me to kind of level set as a matter of what this technology is, so that we're all operating from kind of the same sense of or understanding. There's so many people, and there's so much of this, you know, so much of the jargon. I work hard not to use it, but I'm an egghead, so forgive me. It's too late for me. Save yourself. But let's talk about just briefly, what is money? Because so often people ask me, well, what is, you know, guaranteeing the value of a particular coin or token? And I often kick that question back. What's guaranteeing the value of our dollar? We haven't been on the gold standard in decades, right? It's the full faith and credit of the government. As some other governments where someone has money for one day and doesn't when they wake up the next day. So when you think about money as a social contract, as a social agreement, there's some fundamental things that we all agree to as we pay for things, we receive money, et cetera, that it requires trust. Trust is a word that we hear all the time in the space. And the blockchain ecosystem is not the absence of trust, but it is a shift from a trusted intermediary to verifiable open source public facing code in many respects. There are also permission chains and the like. But this idea that it will hold its value over time, that you can use it for merchants and services, and that it will hold its value over the future as well. So the security in money, think about where that comes from. And also think about things that predated printed money. So we didn't always have physical cash in a note, right, in the way that we think about it now. We had cowrie shells and salt and sugar, gold, silver, and other commodities, and unfortunately the scourge of human beings at one time. People agree to particular value, and it is a social contract and agreement. The same is true in the crypto space as well. But let's start here with digital cash for a digital age. As I've said, if you've used PayPal, Venmo, et cetera, you know what it's like to not physically touch money, but to move value. And now being able to do so on a peer-to-peer basis rather than going through some trusted intermediary to facilitate it when people didn't know or trust each other. They needed someone to kind of de-risk that says, if I provide this service, I'm going to get this payment. So think of it a bit in that way. When Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, or they are, we do not know. So, you know, claim your own Satoshi. This idea of a peer-to-peer means of cash that operated outside of a government or business system. That didn't mean it had to be illegal. It means it's an alternative that may create a customer service problem as we move forward as well. But perhaps start to think about it in this way when you think about the commonalities and also the distinctions between crypto and fiat. Fiat is government-issued money. And let's focus on BTC or Bitcoin and the U.S. dollar to go back and forth and to evaluate them on these five metrics. You have who manages the financial system, how the actual value holds its value, or the coin in this case holds its value over time versus the dollar. Mentioned the full faith and credit of the United States government in the case of the U.S. dollar, When you think about the actual system of supply and demand and the verification of assets as being a common experience rather than siloed for a particular entity by in terms of a government, for example. Are you going to have physical bills and coins? Obviously, in the case of crypto, you do not. Obviously, in the case of fiat for now, you do. There's some active conversations about central bank digital currencies that would operate above the retail bank level, presenting some interesting opportunities, but some significant challenges that I think others will talk about on a different panel or discussion about financial privacy, which is critical. And then finally, what you can do with it, which people ask me all the time. More and more merchants are accepting it as well. And so time will tell. But this is a revolution, or certainly an evolution. Time will tell if it's a revolution. Blockchain, quickly, you're thinking about a system of managing transaction balances and accounts. Transactions and balances. In the same way, if your bank, if I were to send you $100, my bank has to reconcile it at the end of the day. Yours has to reconcile it at the end of the day. If I were sending you stocks, the time to finality is the trade plus 2 days. It can take quite a long time. Blockchain is a different way to manage data in a decentralized fashion so that there is not one central entity that's responsible for accounting, but that is a system that is based on software. The software hard codes the rules. The rules are there if you read code or find someone who does. But it's not as complicated as we make it out to be. When you think about the evolution of full centralization to full distribution or decentralization, we're in that middle that represents 2.0. Fully distributed on a peer-to-peer basis instead of the intermediaries that we experience now. So think of this as a decentralized means of managing transactions and balances, also referred to as a ledger. So you'll hear that terminology quite a bit as well. And at the end of the day, if none of that is hitting, think of that group text. I don't particularly care for group text for this very reason, but you're in a group text with 10 other people. You decide to delete it from your phone. Now, forget the fact that it's going to a centralized server. I get all that. Like, stay with me. But you delete it from your phone. That record persists on the other 9 phones and may persist as long as at least one person has that record of that conversation. Is a very rudimentary way, but hopefully a helpful way to start to think of how blockchains function in terms of managing data. So why should it matter to us as lawyers, law students, policymakers? It should matter to us because we are the true problem solvers. We're the ones in the future who will be the future lawyers and those who will represent people in this future dynamic of Web3. And what it looks like will largely depend on the policy decisions that are made today, to be sure. So in closing, I just want to remind you that blockchain has been touted as this extremely disruptive revolution. And it hasn't yet upended Web 2.0 as we know it, but it certainly is revolutionary. And this is particularly true given its impact as an increasingly viable alternative to the existing financial system. The technology is really exciting because it's highly versatile. The first use case was disrupting financial systems, but that will change as there's some particular impact to many different industries as a different way to do business, and we should be exploring those opportunities. A friend of mine says, blockchain is not hot sauce. You cannot use it on everything. And I actually agree with that. It's not for everything. Sometimes a good old fashioned centralized database is perfectly fine, but we should be asking the questions and we should be able to have those conversations so that the lawyers of today, the future lawyers of tomorrow, and policymakers are well versed and able to meet the moment of where we're moving. And regardless of the outcome, that we as advocates, advisors, and invaluable problem solvers have this really, really exciting opportunity and indeed a responsibility. That responsibility to discover ways to embrace innovation as the story and the code is being written and positioning ourselves to be prepared for the future and to do so today, because the future is now and it begins with us. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to the Tech Intersect podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you love it, please tell the world. If not, go ahead and tell me. And in either case, drop a comment or ping me on social media at IPProfEvans with the hashtag TechIntersect. And finally, a quick reminder on digital safety. There are a lot of scammers out there impersonating me and others, and I need your help. Now hear this, and remember, I will never slide into your DMs to say peace and blessings or hey, and I will never reach out to solicit your time or your money on social media, like ever. I'm not a trader. I am an educator and an attorney licensed in 4 states. Thank you very much. I'm here to inform, inspire, and empower. No cap. And definitely no Forex. So be careful, make good choices, and remember, I developed an entire free masterclass about the topic of digital safety in the crypto space. So check out secureyourcryptobag.com for more information. That's secureyourcryptobag.com. All right, that's all for this episode. Until next time, continue to shine.